Okay, folks, in the honor of keeping us on time, I'm just going to close the door. Okay, maybe not, because I can't get the door closed. So this session is promoting health and wellness in yourself as a physiotherapist. I happen to have a bit of a bias to this one. I'm Sharon Switzer McIntyre from U of T, and Anna has been working on this particular presentation for a while and has piloted on several of us at U of T. And I can tell you that you are in for an amazing hour. So Anna, thank you and welcome.
Thank you. All right, is this working? Okay, perfect. So I'll introduce myself. Can everyone hear me? Okay, perfect. So my name's Anna, I'm a physiotherapist, and I've been working for around 2 years now in outpatient physiotherapy at Norfolk General. And on the side, I create workshops such as these. Really, my interest is about health and wellness in ourselves as physiotherapists. I think we focus a lot on clinical care, and that's important, but I think it's equally as important taking care of ourselves as clinicians, as well as I'm very interested in the student population and promoting mental health in students. So today, we're going to talk about three main things. The first thing I'm going to talk about is positive psychology. What is it and how it can be applied in healthcare? The second part of my talk is going to be all about ourselves as physiotherapists. How do we take care of ourselves? And then I'll talk about two or three tools for resiliency against stress and burnout. So first of all, what is positive psychology? With a show of hands, has anyone heard of this field before or know what it is? Okay, good. So positive psychology is the science that tries to understand optimal human functioning. It's also been described as the science of happiness and fulfillment. And who wouldn't be interested in that, right? Knowing the factors of what a good life is. The founding father is Dr. Martin Seligman. He wrote a really great book called Flourish. And really, before positive psychology existed, 20 years ago, psychology was only focused on the negatives. It was focused on anxiety, depression, bipolar, schizophrenic. How do we get these people with illnesses back to baseline? And that's all they looked at. With this positive psychology movement, they were interested in understanding the factors that brought people's baseline up. What were the factors that made people happier? What were the factors that made people had more meaning in their lives and fulfillment? So really, 20 years ago in psychology, it was really focused around the disease model. It was getting rid of illnesses and fixing people's weaknesses. And the problem with that model is that your neutral state is the ceiling. You can't really rise above that. Whereas in positive psychology, it's more focused in the health model. It's about building what's right. It's about growing your strengths. And the beautiful thing is that there is no ceiling. So I'm not saying the disease model is all bad, but it's important to have a more balanced approach when we think about health. So in psychology, that really parallels well with our healthcare system. If you think about it, well, for myself, I only really see a healthcare professional when something's wrong with me. I have a little confession to make. Prior to this year, I haven't seen my family doctor in 4 years. And that was because there was nothing wrong with me. So I thought my family physician wouldn't really do anything. And if you think about it this way as well, when I had extended health benefits, I was actually really curious to see a psychologist. But because I didn't have a diagnosis of anxiety or depression, I couldn't see her or him. In our physiotherapy education, as well as med school, dentistry school, 90% of our curriculum is focused on this aspect, the illness continuum. We're always learning about the signs and symptoms of clinical patterns and how do we get people back to baseline. I think there is conversation about education, growth, and awareness about how do we get people healthier, but it's not really an equal balance and an equal focus on both illness as well as wellness. So I have a very deep question to ask you. I want you to think about a healthy life in a broader sense that encompasses happiness as well as fulfillment. So to someone next to you, perhaps maybe someone you don't know, it's okay. This is a safe space. I want you to kind of brainstorm the ideas of what makes a happy, healthy, and fulfilling life for you. And hopefully it's not just diet, exercise, and sleep. I hope there's other things to answer that question. So I'll just give you a few minutes to brainstorm those ideas, and then we'll come back as a group. All right, so hearing a lot of great conversations all around. Sorry to cut the conversation short. We can probably talk about hours on this topic. Anyone realize that there are common threads to your answers of what you discussed? Yeah, so a balance between like work life and your personal life, family life. Mm-hmm. One more? Yeah. Yeah, so having that space where you don't think about your business or work. Very good. So I'm going to talk about a model in positive psychology that outlines the factors of a good life, or happiness, fulfillment, and health. So it's called the PERMA-V model. So I'll go through each letter. So P stands for positivity. So whether you have a positive outlook on life. Naturally, as humans, we have something called a negativity bias. And what that means is if 5 good things happen to you that day and there's 1 negative thing, your mind definitely focuses on the negative. And back in the day when we were a hunter-gatherer society, that really played an important role, because if something negative happened, that meant life or death, and we had to focus it on it. But now in modern society, it's not as useful always focusing on the negative. So really retraining our minds to focus on the positive. So in healthcare, sometimes working, it's so easy to get caught up in the politics, the job demands, that it's so easy to focus on the negatives. But sometimes maybe what we have to try to remember are the gifts of practice, that it's really a privilege to go into work every day to be helping people change their lives. It's also about experiencing positive emotions. So positive emotions is not just about being happy, but it's a whole spectrum. So maybe it's feeling in love, feeling joy, being in awe of nature or someone else. And it's not about never feeling negative emotions, but it's about having a healthy balance of both. E stands for engagement. How engaged are you in everyday life? Are you ruminating in the past, or are you very anxious about the future? Are you really living in the moment? I know when I was a student 2 years ago, I was so anxious about the future. I was so focused on just passing the next test, passing my internship, passing the clinical exam, getting a job, getting a better job. How am I ever going to save for a house? It was always these next milestones, and I was really not truly living in the present. And I thought that I would be happy after I've achieved that next milestone. But guess what? There's always going to be a next one. R stands for relationships, and this is by far the most important factor out of all of these. As humans, we're hardwired for high-quality connections, where we feel a sense of belonging and where we feel like we can trust our family and friends. M is for meaning. I like to split this off with a small m, small meaning, and a big meaning. So the small m is, what is the meaning of the everyday things you do? What's the meaning of me doing this workshop? What's the meaning of me being a physiotherapist? Well, it gives me great purpose because I feel like I'm contributing to society when I'm working as a physio. And then the big meaning is, what's the meaning of life? And sorry, guys, I can't answer that for you. But for a lot of people, that is a religious or a spiritual answer. A is achievement. So having a sense of achievement in accomplishing your goals, not only professional goals, but also your personal goals. So originally, the model was only the PERMA model without the V, and it was criticized for being too neck up, so only worrying about the mind. So in 2015, Dr. Seligman realized that the V, vitality, is also very important, and that's what we classically think of as health: eating right, exercise, and sleep. So when we think about living a healthy lifestyle, many people only go to the physical aspects, like eating right, sleeping, exercising, but there's a whole spectrum of health and wellness that we need to be aware of, especially as physiotherapists, where our mind goes to exercise. I wanted to talk about two more models of healthcare. So on this side, it's about our Western medicine. So in Western medicine, really our philosophy of health is getting rid of disease. So the absence of disease equals to health. And we really have this mentality of medicine that it's a war against the disease. It's very prevalent in the language we used. I remember 2 years ago at SickKids, they had that SickKids versus campaign with the kids and the superhero capes, and it was a war against disease. It's very pervasive in our language as well. You always hear the phrase, so-and-so lost their battle with cancer. So it's really surrounded around a disease model. Let's get rid of what's bad in order for you to be healthy. In Western medicine, it's also a very reductionist approach. Reductionism means that if you understand the individual parts of a system, then you can understand the whole. So for example, in healthcare, we have a specialist for everything. We have a cardiologist, neurologist, PT, OT, psych. Everything is segregated and fragmented for specialty. And while that is really good, if I have a heart problem, I want to see a specialist. That's very good. But the other side is that our healthcare system is very fragmented. You know, you come to see me as a physiotherapist, but I can't deal with your psych issues. On the other hand, in Eastern medicine, their perception of health is more about integrity, adaptability, continuity, and their outlook on medicine is more of a partnership with the healthcare professional. It's about cultivating that relationship to enhance self-regulatory capacities. It's more of a holistic approach, but the difficulty is finding scientific evidence for that because it's so complicated. So they view the body more as an ecosystem rather than pipes and an electric system. What's really beautiful is this new field called mind-body medicine, where it hopes to bridge Eastern philosophies with Western philosophies and their mindset on healthcare. And it aims to provide the scientific reasoning and evidence behind a holism approach. And in fact, there is no separation from the mind and the body. It's so interconnected through immune systems, the endocrine system, as well as the neurological system. And really the leader in this kind of research is through Harvard Medical School, where they're giving a scientific rationale of why we need to take a look at the body as a whole rather than fragments in different parts of the healthcare system. So far I talked about our healthcare system, how we place a lot of the focus on the disease model, and that we as physiotherapists, we need to be aware that there are other facets of health and wellness and happiness besides the traditional healthy lifestyle, and that our mental health and our physical health are so interconnected. The next part is all about ourselves, taking care of ourselves. We all know this, right? Don't bend with your back, bend with your knees when we do transfers, when we are practicing as clinicians. We spend a lot of time talking about this. But what about our emotional health? What do we do when a patient comes to you and tells you they're getting abused? What do we do when people are telling you about their suicidal thoughts? How do we cope with that, and how do we maintain that energy that we had as students, as new grads, to maintain passionate about our career? I want to tell you a story. I'm only 2 years out of school. The first year when I came out from school, I had three or four people on my caseload that were suicidal, were experiencing domestic abuse, or had depression. And this really, really affected my life. On the weekends, I would stay up like feeling really worried about them. I didn't really know if I was doing the right thing or not. I started being more withdrawn in my circle of friends, and they saw that too. I was becoming more irritated and angry and emotional more easily. And at one point, I thought to myself, is physiotherapy really right for me if I'm feeling this way every weekend? And I almost felt like, oh, maybe I made a wrong career choice. But I quickly realized I was not the only one feeling this way. And in fact, many people of a helping, relationship-intense profession feel this. And it's called burnout. So we use the word burnout a lot, but really it's studied in psychological research. And there are three characteristics. The first one is emotional exhaustion. You feel that your emotional resources are depleted, and at a psychological level, you have nothing else left to give. Depersonalization. You start being very negative and cynical about your life, and you start dehumanizing people. And the last one is reduced professional achievement. You don't feel as happy on the job because you're not as engaged. The warning signs of burnout. I think I felt all of these things, exhaustion, I won't go through all of them, but definitely the dread of working with certain patients. I remember I would get a list every morning, go through it, and I see that one name, I'll be like, oh, my day is over. difficulty separating work life from personal life, definitely, and anger and irritability. Why should we care about burnout? Burnout is associated with diminished sense of enjoyment of career, increased use of alcohol and drugs, anxiety, depression, and suicidal ideation. And why should healthcare policy people care about it? Well, it's associated with missing work, taking more sick days, job turnover, and as a result, decreased quality and safety of patient care and patient satisfaction. Another term commonly used besides burnout is compassion fatigue. So compassion fatigue is described as the cost of caring for others in emotional and physical pain. It's this deep physical and emotional exhaustion, and it's a pronounced change in the helper's ability to feel empathy. So how I separate the two is that burnout is really an umbrella term. Anyone can feel burnout, whether they're a physiotherapist, an accountant, a businessman. Compassion fatigue is a little bit more specific for those that are caring for others in pain. But for our purposes, I'm going to use them interchangeably. Burnout. There's been more and more research in the topic of burnout, especially in healthcare professions. I really like this title, Burnout Among Healthcare Professions, a call to explore and address this under-recognized threat to safe and high-quality care. If I haven't convinced you enough why this is important, why do physios need to learn about this? There was a study in 2017 that 52% of physiotherapists internationally were not aware of what compassion fatigue was. So there were someone like me. They were feeling all these changes, but they didn't really understand why. And in a study in 2015, 37% of physiotherapists in Alberta were experiencing a high degree of burnout. In the next few years, with our growing aging population, that's going to mean higher job demands for us. The theme in healthcare around these days is do more with less. And because of that, that might lead to emotional exhaustion. That might lead us to withdraw more energy. And that means spending time less with patients, less patient-centered, and more errors cognitively. So it's ironic, right? I talked about positive psychology and I'm telling you about what's wrong, but there's a flip side. I'm gonna talk about strategies to avoid burnout. I also remember as a student when I would tell, you know, my supervisor or anyone that I was feeling burnt out, they would be like, oh, Anna, you're just young. You're not old enough to feel burnt out, or take a vacation. And really, those were the two responses I got. But really, there are a multitude of ways to increase our resiliency to burnout and stress. It's really a multimodal approach. There's no single answer. I'm going to talk about the first three strategies. So the first one is self-awareness. So to really do anything, you need to be aware that you're stressed and you're feeling a bit burnt out. Like this little comic here, this guy is obviously stressed, but he has no idea. It's taking note of changes. So emotionally, you might be more irritated, angry. Cognitively was an interesting one. I started making more errors in my charting. I realized that my decision-making process was a little slower. Physically, you can feel sluggish. Behaviorally, I was actually starting to splurge a lot more. My spending was a little out of control. Relationships, I was definitely more withdrawn from social situations. And it's this idea of mega cognitive awareness. When you're really, really stressed in that moment, maybe you have the patient's family members yelling at you, they're upset. It's the ability to take a step back and analyze yourself as a third person. And it's really that skill that is truly self-awareness. We're going to do a quick activity on self-awareness. I want you to think about two activities that deplete your energy, that kind of suck the life out of you. And I want you to think about two activities that charge you up when you're feeling a little bit low. I'll give you a quick example. Depleting energy would definitely, for me, be working with a challenging patient, maybe someone that's crying, yelling, angry. A charging energy activity for me is taking a walk during my lunch hour and not sitting at my desk and just getting a fresh breath of air. So turning to your partners again, I want you to think about two activities for depleting energy and two activities that charge your energy up, both maybe personally and professionally. Okay, and go ahead. All right. Okay, coming back to the room. So what were some ideas that people had around that? I would love to hear kind of what depletes your energy and what charges it up. Everyone always has like different ideas, and this is very personal. So I'd love if someone can share maybe one example of each. Okay, yes. So I'll repeat that. He said depleting things would be pointless meetings that kind of go on and on and on. Yes. And what charges you up?
Not going for walking.
I think really, even though I might have more charting to do later on, I think for me, just stepping away from my desk and taking a walk really helps. Yes. Maybe one more person that wants to share.
So that kind of sets the tone for the day, even though if I haven't done anything yet. So that's kind of what depletes my energy. But charging energy is just kind of going home, exercising, like you said.
Yes.
And also, you know, seeing my pets, my cats.
Yeah. Very nice.
Home, so, yeah.
Very nice. Yes. A very good physio answer, exercise. Very good. So let's talk a little bit more about stress and why it matters. I think a lot of presentations talked about this, but I want to talk about the physiological changes. So at work, when we perceive a stressful situation, maybe it's a very heated conversation with a patient, with a patient's family, that can create psychological stress. And when that happens, there are a downstream effects that happens. Particularly, you release ACTH, which is adrenal corticotropic hormone, and that activates your flight or fight response, your sympathetic nervous system. And as a result, your cortisol levels increase, your nitric oxide decreases, and your levels of norepinephrine and epinephrine come up. I think what's really interesting that we often forget is that we have an innate ability to dial this down. And it's called the relaxation response. We have the ability to dial down our sympathetic nervous system when we're really agitated, to dial that down. And how do we do that? It's through something called mind-body interventions. So mind-body interventions can elicit the relaxation response. There are two key ingredients. The first one is repetition. It doesn't matter what you're repeating, whether it's a word, a phrase, a thought, muscular activity, breathing. And the second component is returning to that repetition when you start to think about different things. So some examples are, if you're religious, prayer. And if you're not religious, it can be anything. It can be maybe a personal mantra that you have. So sometimes it's a little cheesy, but when I'm about to enter a difficult situation, in my head, I'm like, you can do this, Anna. You can do this, Anna. And it actually helps. Or another example is that sometimes when I'm about to deal with a difficult patient, in my head, I say, I just want the best for you. I just want the best for you. And that leads me to a place of calm and steadiness before I go in. Others in research have shown that yoga, tai chi, qigong have also elicited the relaxation response. And I think my favorite one out of all of these is meditation on the breath. Because we breathe anywhere, anytime, it's accessible. So during lunchtime, when I don't have the luxury to go out for a walk, I spend at least 5 minutes on meditation of the breath, and that I find helps me calm down and resets my mind for my patients in the afternoon. So that's what we're gonna do right now for around 4 minutes. I'm gonna lead you on meditation of the breath. Something really easy to do, you can do anytime, anywhere. So when you're comfortable, well, get into a comfortable position in your chair. And I want you to slowly close your eyes. And we're gonna focus on taking slow, deep breaths using our belly. When you breathe in, I want you to think about breathing all the oxygen in that's going to nourish your body, breathing in positivity. And when you breathe out, I want you to think about releasing all of the stress that you've been holding. Whether that's stress in your mind, or whether that's stress that you're holding in your shoulders, around your face, or maybe even your hands. Focusing on the breath coming in and the breath out. Filling your body up with positivity and oxygen, and breathing out any tension and stress. It's natural for your mind to wander and think about other things, but gently bring it back to focus on the breath. As you breathe out, try to see if you can release even more tension. When you're ready, come back to the room. You can open your eyes again. So, how did that feel for people? It was good? Yeah, very relaxing. So, that was only 3 minutes, 3 minutes of your time. And it's a really good tool to use when you're feeling very, you know, maybe frustrated during your job situation or anything in life, really. For those of you who are interested in maybe doing meditation, there's many apps on your phone that you can download. Personally, I really like Headspace. It really explains what is meditation, and it's a guided meditation as well. So far we talked about self-awareness. I think we all know what stresses us out, what depletes our energy and recharging it. But it's about taking note of when we do feel depleted and doing something about it. We talked a little bit about mind-body interventions, and we practiced meditation. And the last tool that I'm going to talk about is cognitive reframing, or having a positive perspective. So if for those of you that went to the talk before this in this room, Andrew talked a little bit about growth mindsets, and that's what I'm going to talk a little bit more today about. Has anyone heard of the concept of fixed mindset versus growth mindset? Show of hands. Yeah, okay. So what is a mindset? A mindset is a set of beliefs or a way of thinking that can determine your behavior. So the concept of fixed and growth mindset is really developed by this psychologist, Carol Dweck. Her book is fantastic if you have an interest in this. So she describes two mindsets. The first mindset is called a fixed mindset. I like to conceptualize it with a rock. So it's thinking that your intelligence or your abilities is innate. You're either born with it or you're not. You're either smart or you're not. You're either a natural athlete or you're not. You're either a good physiotherapist or you're not. Whereas in a growth mindset, you're like Plato. You're malleable. You make mistakes, but you continue to grow. And you're more curious about the process of attaining intelligence and ability. So I'll kind of go over the two mindsets and how they perceive different situations. So in a fixed mindset, you're really focused on the outcome, and you think that others are always judging you. So the first time I gave this talk, maybe the third time I gave this talk, I was actually really scared because I was really nervous because I was so scared that the audience would judge me if I made an error. So at that time, I definitely had a fixed mindset. In a growth mindset, you're more curious about the process, the learning process. What does failure mean? In a fixed mindset, failure means that it's your identity. I am a failure. I'm just not talented enough. So maybe if you're working with patients and something doesn't go right, you think you've failed as a physiotherapist. Whereas in a growth mindset, you separate the failure as an action item. It's not a part of your identity, and you believe that you need to work harder or differently. What does success mean? In a fixed mindset, it means I'm smart. I can rest now. You know, I have my MSCPT degree. I can rest. I don't need to do anymore. In a growth mindset, it means, okay, I learned something. What else? How can I sustain that knowledge and do better? In a fixed mindset, effort means if it doesn't go easily enough, that means I'm not good enough. In a growth mindset, effort is the process of what makes me smarter or more talented. What does trying something new mean? In a fixed mindset, it means I might appear dumb. In a growth mindset, it means that it's an opportunity to learn, grow, and develop. When do you feel smart? In a fixed mindset, you want perfect performance right away. In a growth mindset is when you learn something new. And lastly, I think I talked about this already, in a fixed mindset, you're really worried about others judging you, whereas in a growth mindset, you see each individual as a resource that you can learn from. So in my opinion, throughout graduate school and undergrad, I think a lot of graduate students have a fixed mindset. And the reason being why, this is purely my opinion, is because we're raised in an educational system that's focused on outcomes. It's all about getting A's and A pluses throughout almost for 20 or 20 plus years of our lives. So to suddenly switch our mindset to be more focused about the process is a very difficult thing to do as we transition from students to clinicians. So I'll give you one strategy to shift to a growth mindset. And it's all about asking different questions. I know it might be a little hard to see, but I'm going to go through this with you. So this is called the choice map. Essentially, whenever something happens in our life, a conflict, we're upset, we start over here. And we tend to go down the judger path. Essentially, we react to what's happening. So let me guide you through a scenario. So I work in private practice orthopedics, and in my first 3 months of working, I was very insecure whether people would come back or not. So for example, let's say this guy named Bob, I've only seen him for 2 visits, and suddenly Bob, you know, no-shows, and he stops coming forever. Immediately, my mind wants to react, and I want to ask, okay, whose fault is it? It must be Bob. He's so rude, you know. Like, why is he not coming back? Or it can go the other way. I can start blaming myself. Oh, maybe I'm not a good enough physiotherapist. Like, I'm just a new grad. What do I know? So you start assigning blame on others or yourself, and what you can do is you can end up in the judger pit where you constantly blame yourself, like, why am I such a failure? Or you're focused on them. Why are they so stupid, so rude? And the worst part about that is you ask yourself, why bother? Why bother for change? So in any situation, our gut feeling is always to react, to assign blame to ourselves or others. But the beautiful thing about this map is you can switch lanes. You can switch lanes onto the learner path. On the learner path, you're more curious about win-win situations, win-win solutions, and you're more solutions-focused. So the questions you ask yourself are, okay, Bob stopped coming. What exactly happened? It's taking the emotions out of that situation. What are the facts? What assumptions am I making? Am I assuming that Bob is just a rude person? Maybe there's other things going on. Maybe he has a family emergency. There could be many, many different things. I really like this question. What am I responsible for? And with all of those questions that you've thought of, what are my choices now? What's my best case scenario? And by being on the learner path, you're actually more curious about the situation, about what happened, so you can actually do something about it. So that is the judger and learner pathway. So the key points of this second part is that burnout and compassion fatigue is prevalent amongst any helping professional, especially in a profession as physiotherapist, is very relationship heavy. And it's almost an ethical duty for us to take care of ourselves before we can take care of others. As our job demands continue to increase for the next 5-10 years, I think it's more important than ever to teach students about burnout and burnout prevention and also give them the tools for resiliency against stress. Today I talked about 3 tools. I talked about self-awareness and management, talked about mind-body interventions, and talked about shifting to a growth mindset. But really, it's only 3 tools out of a whole toolbox. Having, you know, social support, having healthy lifestyles, a self-care plan, it's all very important for resiliency to stress. And that's it. I want to acknowledge a few people. I want to acknowledge Sharon over there and Eason. There were 2 profs at University of Toronto that really helped mentor me through this process of creating this talk. I want to acknowledge the Olive Wallace Pester Fellowship that I received during convocation that allowed me to study positive psychology at the Flourishing Center, as well as this wonderful course in mind-body medicine at Harvard. And really, they are, I think, the leaders in mind-body medicine. And I think for the last 15 minutes, I can take any questions, if there are any.
Thank you, Anna. And Olive was very proud of what you've done with her scholarship. Any questions for Anna?
Yeah.
What kind of support do you think that we should be, either as clinicians or as when we come across students? I'm very big on this because in my clinic, I preach work balance, like work-life balance with all my clinicians. And as hard as it is for me to say, sure, you can take the day off, but it's just as important for them to do that, right? Because I understand that if they're not happy, they're not. Our patients are going to feel that too. But it took me a while to get to that. I had to go through working at a lot of places that didn't acknowledge that, and that's what drove me to open up my own practice.
Yeah.
But why? How can we get that across to employers that are not, whether, and I think I'm a better judge of that because I go through it myself. So I make sure my staff make sure they take the breaks that they need to. But what else can we do? What needs to change in kind of our education system? Because nobody talks about that aspect in school. Nobody, not even the business aspect of even owning your own business. Everything is, you know, you just kind of figure it out as you go. But what, is there anything? I'm not sure if you came across anything that is being done.
So when I think about, you know, burnout prevention and advocacy for mental health, I think of it as two separate things. There can be personal strategies and organizational strategies. For organizational change to happen is going to take a long time, but being a business owner, you have a little bit more control. I think it's starting to have those conversations, continue the conversations of, okay, like, you know, this is how you did on, you know, your ACP, your clinical evaluation, but how are you? Like, actually having an interest in how people are doing rather than only the business outcomes, only the patient outcomes, and taking an interest in the employees themselves. A second part of it is really role modeling the behavior. I think, you know, you really have to live the talk. You have to practice self-care, and in turn, that can radiate towards the people that you work with. I'm a strong believer that in every healthcare organization, you know, you have your yearly evals, but I think that there should be a person that sits down with employees and asks them, okay, how are you actually doing as well? I think that's really important.
Great, thank you. Very good question. Any other questions, thoughts, experiences with mindfulness?
Thanks, Anna. That was really good. I guess one, it's more of a comment, but what I have found is that almost the idea of self-care, like I have to have some self-compassion that like I'm worthy of taking a break. And if like I was a better academic or a better clinician, I don't need the breaks. You can just keep going, yada, yada. But reflecting that that's not actually like a weakness that's going to make me sustainable is still something I'm figuring out, but I wonder if you just had a comment or thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think when I first entered physiotherapy and started working, I had this idea of being like a perfectionist and that I have to be like the best clinician ever, like I have to heal the world, I have to make sure all my patients get better. And over time, this took a toll on me because I realize, you know, I can't work 20 hours of the day. I can't work and come home and research everything. So I've learned to be a high achiever instead of a perfectionist. And I've learned that sometimes good enough is good enough. Like, I'm going to work 9 to 5 and maybe spend like 1 hour reviewing and that's it. And having like a time limit for that and also prioritizing my health as well. Because if you prioritize your self-care and your health, you will become a better clinician in turn. And it's almost like we have to have self-compassion in order to have compassion for others. If you don't have compassion for yourself and what you're going through, it's hard to have compassion and empathy for others.
Great. I think that's a very important point, is thinking about us and, as you said, Kyle, giving ourselves permission to be reflective and take care of ourselves. Take those that time we need if we need to step away for a minute, as opposed to pushing through and thinking that we're okay when we're not okay.
I just have one more comment, actually. You know, in my workplaces as a new grad, there are no supports for me, unfortunately, on burnout. So I've decided that I'm going to be the one that leads these team meetings about self-care, and people are receptive. So I invite you on that challenge that you can make a difference in your workplace. You can be the one that has these kind of conversations with your staff members, because it's going to be hard for organizational change to happen, but it begins with one person.
Thank you, Anna. That was I really got a lot out of your talk, I must say. But this question is coming along, something that's been going behind the scenes with some of my younger colleagues who are going through something I went through, is that you graduate, you work, and then all of a sudden you have your family. And then so you're having compassion fatigue from your patients, but you come home to your toddlers or your teenagers, And now I'm dealing with senior parents who are having cognitive issues. So I'm getting you're getting pulled in your other life balances that I call compassion fatigue. And you really, like, that draws your energy too. And I think that's a lot of times, like, it's not just work. It's whatever is going on. And I think a lot of us are talking now, getting into the next stage of their lives, maybe being a parent and knowing that, wow, my energy is going even more so. And that's a huge step of another area that I don't think is being talked enough about. It's almost like, especially when I look at my younger colleagues who are now becoming mothers, and they're like saying, how did you do it? And it was like, I just said, I gave myself permission to say I couldn't do it all. And I had to kind of take a step away.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, I think it's something that is definitely part of the compassion fatigue is what's happening outside of work. But I don't know, maybe you have thoughts there.
For sure. Like, I'm not at that stage of life yet, but whether you're a mom or you're caring for your elderly elderly parents, you're a caregiver, right? So it's really all about a balance between other people care and self-care. If you're always giving, 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 and you're not caring for yourself, then it's going to be this huge imbalance of only caring for others, but not yourself enough.
We have time for one more comment or question.
Thank you. Having graduated more than just 2 years ago, I have to say these conversations certainly were not happening at the schooling level, nor at the start of my career or partway through my career, and it's I found it very interesting and motivating for myself so that I can take care of myself to be a better mother, to be a better spouse, to be a better physiotherapist, and to try not to lose track of who I am as a person, as an individual, and not just as a physio, as a mother, as a friend. It's inspiring. Thank you.
Yeah. I think the big shift for me from being a student to now being 2 years out was that my whole life was surrounded by school, and that was my identity. And then when I first started working, you know, physiotherapist was my identity. But now I've kind of taken a step back that I'm Anna, I'm a person first, and then physiotherapy, yes, it's my career, but there's other aspects that is a part of my identity. And I think that aspect is so important that, you know, even though, you know, our career is important, but it's definitely not everything.
Well, thank you, Anna. Thank you, as Jody said, for opening up the conversation. That's exactly what Anna has been doing for us at U of T, is we've had her come back and she's been talking with our students. And it's really started an interesting conversation in our curriculum. It's started an interesting conversation amongst our student body, amongst our faculty, amongst our clinicians. We've opened up a couple of sessions to our clinicians. So I think it is a really, really, really important conversation to start to have. It's sad that it's taken us so long to get here to have this conversation for those of us who did not graduate 2 years ago. But thank you. Thank you for this presentation today. Thank you for inspiring us to think into the future of mindfulness, mind-body, and really thinking about who we are and putting ourselves first to make sure that we're healthy as well. So thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone. So if you're interested in more, I invite you to leave your email address. I've been working to develop on 3-hour workshops on burnout prevention and resiliency that I've been delivering at University of Toronto as well as different hospitals. Because burnout prevention is talked about with nurses and with physicians, but it's not at all focused in allied health. And I really don't know why, because we obviously feel burnt out too. So if you're at all interested, you can leave your email and I will get back to you.
Thank you. Thank you for attending the session.